Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, listeners. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to the show today. I am very excited to introduce a guest that I think you're all going to learn a lot from. He's kind of somebody that I met at the Aero conference, or I didn't meet, but he's you're a member of Aero, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you were, well, I read about him in the book The Lentil Underground, which, listeners, if you've been listening, I interviewed the woman who wrote The Lentil Underground, and her episode should have posted before this one. And he runs Prairie Heritage Farm in Power, Montana. His name's Jacob Cowgill. And Jacob, I'll just let you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure.
Welcome to the show, Jacob.
Yeah, so my wife and I run a small farm on the Fairfield Bench, which is northwest of Great Falls, about 7 miles east of Power. And we're both from the area. I was born and raised outside of San Coulee, which is northeast of Great Falls, and my wife, Courtney, was born and raised north of Great Falls outside of Dutton, Montana. And we initially had met each other in junior high when I was in eighth grade and she was in sixth grade. And so we'd known each other for a long time and just kind of led our separate lives. Both went to the University of Montana and ran across each other there, and both left Montana after college and were gone for about a year and a half. And pretty much within the same week, I think we moved back to Montana, and that's when we re-met.
Weird.
And we re-met and started dating and eventually got married, and we're living in Missoula at the time and decided that we wanted to move back closer to home. And so that's how we ended up back home, which, you know, was a big region home, but we are close to both of our parents, and I wanted to start a farm, and Courtney was willing to go along with it. And so we started our farm in 2009 on some leased ground outside of Conrad, which is north of about 60 miles north of Great Falls. And then in 2012, we found our own place here on the Fairfield Bench, and we've been there since. We primarily grow fresh vegetables for farmers market and CSA. We're starting to get into more vegetable seed production, and we also raise some ancient heritage wheats and barley, so we focus on unique varieties. We're very small scale when it comes to grain. I mean, we're talking on less than 20 acres.
Cool. I'm excited to hear about that, because I've been wondering, like, you know, since I just read The Lentil Underground and I was at the Aero thing, like, we took the tour of Dave's Timeless Seeds place, because my husband and I, we have 20 acres, but we just, like, have a very, very small area that we garden. He built, like, what I call the mini farm this year. That's probably, like, I don't know, maybe a third of an acre, a quarter of an acre there. So I'm wondering about, like, can we grow some of those great, amazing lentils on a very small piece like that?
Yeah, you can. And certainly for a home scale, you can grow, and I can't remember the exact number, but you can grow quite a bit for your personal use on a very small amount of land. The trick comes in the, not so much the planting, but in the harvesting, the threshing, and the cleaning. And so for us, we grow, you know, on a bit larger scale, that it would just be, it just would not be feasible to even to plant, let alone harvest and thresh and clean by hand. So we do utilize a grain drill to plant it, and a combine to harvest, and we have some small seed cleaning equipment to deal with it after it's been harvested. But for a home gardener, those things aren't insurmountable. Just a little more labor intensive, and there's lots of different techniques to get the grain free of the head and winnowed to be clean enough to eat.
Okay. So do you want to tell us about your because I always kind of like to start the show asking about your very first gardening experience. Like, how old were you? Who were you with? What'd you grow? Like, where did you start growing?
Well,
gardening.
You know, I don't have any distinct memory of gardening growing up, but my parents both gardened. We had a really big garden when I was a kid. And my dad built this beautiful dry stack stone wall around it. And I don't remember actually working in the garden. And my dad always tells a story about me touching the dirt and crying because I didn't want to get dirty when I was a baby.
I'm like that.
I don't remember that, but I'm sure it's true. But, you know, one thing that I don't know why this always stands out, but I just remember the asparagus patch for some reason. It just seems so prolific. But I don't have any distinct memory of actually as a kid being out there gardening with my parents. Mm-hmm. And so probably my first actual memory of gardening for myself was when I was way older, in my 20s, when I was in college.
Okay. And then I do kind of always like to also ask, like, what does organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening mean to you?
Well, I'd say that it has to, you have to at the very least be giving back more than you take.
Nice.
And, you know, there's it's certainly a complex, pretty complex question. I mean, I think that probably the friendliest thing you could do to the earth is probably not garden. I mean, not turn the soil over and till it you know, because anytime you do that, you are doing a certain amount of harm to the soil life. So that, you know, I think at the very least, you just have to make sure that you're trying to give back more than you actually take.
Okay. And who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques?
I don't know. It was just always a part of me. I don't think that there's any one particular person or people. I think I went from not gardening or even thinking about gardening or farming to gardening and farming, and I just entered the world of organic farming. And there was no transition to organic. There wasn't. I didn't start off using chemicals and then move away from them. I didn't have a history with it, so I think it was just a natural and no-brainer that I go right into organic gardening. There wasn't anybody that inspired me to do that. It just was the way that it was and the way that it should be.
Okay, cool. So then how did you learn how to garden organically then? Or just like you always, like when you started learning how to garden, that was the way you were taught?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's been a steep learning curve for the past, well, I guess it's been nine, ten years. Mm-hmm. And it's been, yeah, real seat of the pants, on the ground learning, which means that you make a ton of mistakes. And, you know, I'd have to say that even now, after 7 years of farming for ourselves on our own place, I'm still very much a beginner. I mean, there's so much to know and learn that I'm still figuring a lot of stuff out. And even some basic stuff I'm still trying to figure out. So yeah, my gardening and farming education has just come by being thrown into it and learning something every year.
Well, don't feel bad. My husband's been gardening for, like, I don't know, 40 or 50 years, and I feel like we're just, like, total beginners because we're, like I said, he tried to plant that mini farm, was kind of like an experiment to see, like, what it would take for us to grow, you know, have, like, a CSA and, you know, start growing food for more than just, like, his big goal has always been to grow enough food for our family so that, you know, we wouldn't have to buy, like, carrots or potatoes or any of that, green beans, you know, stuff like that, and so we were able to do some of that this year. We still had some problems. We've been out of potatoes for a while. Last year we had potatoes through like almost February, and this year I don't know what happened. He planted a ton of potatoes, but we just ate them up, and I don't know. They had a tough time. But just like, I can't even imagine what it's going to take for us to grow, forget 20 share, 100 share someday, just like even 20 shares for a CSA. So,
yeah.
You know, it's always, you're always learning, I think, as gardeners.
You are. And you know, what we know and understand about about the earth, about the soil changes constantly too. I mean, just I'm talking about the experts. Uh-huh. You know, the experts 10 years ago were wrong about some things, and now we're just now understanding a little bit more about the about soil life. And so, you know, we're simultaneously trying to just get a basic grasp of this gardening act, and at the same time, in the background, the experts are still figuring things out. So it's really interesting that, you know, you're trying to do two things at once: learn about it and keep up with what we are slowly starting to understand.
Mm-hmm. And then also there's like the problems with like the, you know, the world is changing, the climate's changing, our, you know, our seasons are changing, and there's that whole piece being thrown in too.
Yep.
Okay, you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
Yeah, you know, our kale grew exceptionally well, and I don't think I can take a whole lot of credit for that. It's just that kale is just such a remarkable plant. You know, we planted one succession in the high tunnel. We have an unheated covered high tunnel for early spring harvest, and then we planted three more successions outside, and so we had a constant supply of kale. And it just every succession just looked remarkable and performed really well. So I was really happy with that.
Cool. So do you plant like different kinds of kale, or just basically one variety, or how does that
work? Well, we typically, in a typical year, and this was not a typical year, but in a typical year, we would plant more or less three basic varieties. One is going to be your dinosaur or lacinato kale, or also known as Tuscan kale. And another one is going to be some kind of green curly kale. And then a third will be, sometimes it'll be a red curly kale or like a red Russian kale. So typically every year we'll plant those three basic varieties, and plant them, maybe do a succession every 4 weeks. And so that by the time the second succession is in and established and we're starting to harvest from that, the first succession may be kind of tapering off. The leaves are getting a little bit tougher and the stem's a little more woody. And so then we transition to the second succession. Now, what made this year not typical was that we typically order our green curly kale seed. We order the winter boar variety, which is a very standard, very hardy, productive hybrid green curly variety. Well, it turns out it's only produced, as I understand, one place in the world. That's, I think, somewhere in the Netherlands. But they had a crop failure, so that means that everybody who relies on winter boar, which is most every market gardener, market farmer, was out of winter boar variety. So it was real eye-opening to us, and we ended up looking for any open-pollinated green curly variety of kale that we could find. And we ended up with, I think, maybe 7 or 8 different varieties that we started in the greenhouse and then transplanted out. And we wanted to find one that we liked, because even though it's called green curly, they're all going to be subtly different. The leaf shape may be different, the color may be different, the taste may be different. And since we're market farmers, we have to grow a variety that we think that our customers will want. And the trick was that we didn't know what it would look like until it was full grown. So we had to grow it to full grown before we could really know. So that was actually ended up being kind of a fun experiment over the course of the season. And we found a few varieties that we really like of open pollinated kale. And so we planted a final succession, a fourth succession of kale in the fall, in the hopes that it'll overwinter, because kale is a biennial crop, so it won't go to, it has to vernalize or has to go through a cold spell in order to produce seed. So if it survives the winter, then it will produce seed next spring, early summer.
And then you're going to save those seeds, and then you'll have your own? Is that the point?
Yeah, the point is that we'll save the seed from our, we have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 5 different varieties out there that we're trying to overwinter. Now, if all 5 survive the winter, then we have to make a decision on which one we want to keep, because they're planted right next to each other, and kale is a crosser, so the varieties will cross with one another at the flower stage. Mm-hmm. And so if we want to maintain variety purity, then we need to only pick one variety to grow. We have to eliminate the other four.
Oh, you have to eliminate all four. Okay.
We have to just keep one variety that we want to save the seed from. Otherwise, it'll cross-pollinate with the other ones.
Okay.
So, yeah, but the point is that we want to find a good, marketable, open-pollinated green curly kale variety and one that can survive the winter where we are, which is pretty harsh. They're pretty harsh winters. Often they're open winters, and we have 30 below spells.
What does that mean, an open winter?
Open winter means that the snow often doesn't stick around. So we get snow, but usually the wind will blow it off. And so snow is a great insulator. Mm-hmm. And so places that have snow over the winter, that snow acts as an insulation blanket for anything underneath, whether that might be an overwintering cover crop or winter wheat or say, for this in this example, kale.
And you know, so in Liz's book, The Lentil Underground, she talks about the, is it the crab trees up by the northern Canadian border? And one of their big problems was erosion. And so you're probably dealing with erosion too, then, if you don't have a blanket of snow to keep your soil down. So is that another reason you like to have the kale in there over the winter?
Well, certainly it'll help with that. Yeah, we want to minimize the amount of bare soil we have going into the fall because of that erosion issue. And because of the high winds we have, that's where most of our erosion comes from. And so the kale will certainly help with that. But if we didn't have the kale there, we would have something else there to keep the soil down.
Okay. And just, I'm just curious, because since we're talking about kale, and like a lot of my guests have talked about kale, and you're talking about a good marketable variety, like, are people using kale mostly for smoothies, or like, what do your customers like want kale for? Like, what are you looking for in your variety, like, that your customers are like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, for us, we're looking at both what our customers will want, but also what we want in a plant. So for example, what we want is something that is tall enough that you don't have to hunch over so far to harvest the leaves. And it was interesting to see these different varieties, how some were very short with lots of leaves, but they were very short, so you had to hunch all the way down to get them. And some are taller, so that as you're picking leaves off the bottom, the stem, the distance between the leaf nodes is greater, so the plant is taller and they're easier to harvest. We're looking for a good standard curly green leaf. Some were a little less curly, even though they were described as green curly. They were a little less curly, and our impression, and of course we don't have the capacity to do these extensive surveys with our customers, is that they probably wouldn't buy something like that when they're expecting the green curly that they typically find in the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And so for us, we're looking for things like that. And of course, whether it produces well for us and it can withstand pest pressures and the wind and things like that. And then for our customers, we want that, like I said, the leaf shape, but also certainly the flavor, you know, if it's tender and sweet. And if it's going to be tough, then we don't want it. And of course, our customers aren't going to want it. But
awesome.
Yeah, no, I think they are using it for smoothies and stir fries. And I mean, the kale is pretty versatile. You can even use it in a raw salad too. And we often promote that.
I have a friend who's like, she's like the super healthy. I'm always like looking at her, and she eats a ton of kale. And I've always been trying to incorporate more kale into my diet. And I was sure I was going to grow kale this year, but then it never did make it into my garden. Well, cool. You told us a lot of neat things there, Jacob. How about something different you're going to try, or something new that you're excited to try next year?
You know, I don't have a whole lot of experience with herbs, and I've been thinking a lot about growing more of those. Things like thyme and rosemary. I had a list of about a half a dozen. We grow basil, which is about the only herb we grow, which does really well, and we love it. It's one of the best things to harvest because it smells so good. But some of these other culinary herbs we'd like to try.
Okay. My big thing is I have a ton of oregano. Oregano is like overrun my garden. I have oregano everywhere. So I've been trying to find something to do with oregano. And I thought I was going to make an oregano pesto this year because somebody gave me a recipe for that, but I never had time to do that either. My gardening time is limited. My husband's really the gardener at our house.
Yeah.
And I just, between my podcast and working, I got to do some things in the garden this year, but not everything. Next year for sure.
That's
but
right.
Yeah,
there's
culinary herbs I think you will do really well with because I think they're very popular. And I was so surprised to see like these packets like at Thanksgiving of like 5 herbs for $5, like a little tiny thing of sage and a little bit of rosemary and a little bit of, and I was like, oh my goodness, look at that. So good idea. Tell us about something that didn't work so well this season that didn't maybe come out the way you thought it was going to.
Well, our squashes and our green beans did not do well, and I need to take a look at when I planted them. I may have planted them just a little bit late. I didn't think they were that late, but they didn't. They grew fine, and then we had a frost on August 23rd, which is a pretty early frost even for us.
Yeah.
And so that really caught us by surprise. I mean, we knew it was going to be cold, but not below freezing cold. So that pretty much wiped all that out, which was unfortunate. So that definitely didn't grow well. I mean, you put a lot of effort into taking care of something like that and end up with nothing. It's a little disappointing.
Yeah. Wow. We harvested a lot of green beans this year on this side of the mountains. And I talked to a friend of mine who lives near me. Kind of near me, because even though she's near me, her episode I recorded last night, we still have quite a difference in growing season from where she is from where I am. But she said her green beans were prolific this year.
Yeah.
But we certainly did not have a frost in August this year. I'm surprised you guys had a frost that early.
Yeah, it was just one night. One night for about 2 hours, it dropped below 32.
Yeah.
And that was it. And then, of course, it was fine until sometime in November, or excuse me, in September.
No, those are bush beans or pole beans?
Yeah, bush beans.
Okay.
And beans are one of the most susceptible plants to frost, so it wasn't a surprise that that it wiped them out.
Yeah. How about something that you find is easy to grow and generally successful every time?
You know, I'd say beets are pretty consistent. Okay. Yeah, you don't have to mess with anything in the greenhouse, you know, so you're not worried about making sure that they're watered or that they're not too hot or not too cold in the greenhouse or transplanting. And then you go through the transplant shock. I mean, you just direct seed them and they tend to germinate quickly and oftentimes ahead of the weeds and grow fast. And then they can, you know, well, we planted a bunch of fall beets and boy, they've just been amazing. They can handle frost and.
Mm-hmm. And like just red beets, or did you plant any of those golden beets?
No, just the red beets.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I love beets, and like my husband pickles beets, and then I put beets on my salad all winter long. And since I've been doing that, I hardly ever buy a tomato in the winter because I think pickle beets are just the perfect red for your salad.
Yeah.
So that's a great one. How about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
Well, you know, I don't think I would steer anybody away from anything. I think it's definitely important to try, because no matter what happens, you're going to learn something. But if I were to tell new gardeners what might be more challenging, I might say. Well, I might, you know, I don't know. That's a hard one. I mean, I think that, you know, things like eggplant and bell peppers require a little more heat than we often have in Montana. But, you know, I know lots of farmers who plant them outside. We plant them under some cover to give them a little extra heat. But I know Montana farmers who plant them outside, and they do well enough, so.
Okay, cool. Well, that's inspiring. People will think, okay, cool. What's your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is there anything you got to get yourself, force yourself to get out there and do?
Yeah, I hate cleanup. and I'm thinking about that now because it's at the top of my mind, but I'm talking about like fall cleanup, you know, after the after the season's mostly done and you've got row covers strewn about and bits of plastic and drip tape and, you know, piles of stuff that you just didn't have time to deal with in the middle of summer that now you have to deal with. I think that's my least favorite thing.
Cool. That's a good one. How about your favorite activity to do in the garden?
Well, if things are going well, which they aren't always going well, but if things are going well and feel good about where we are in the season, then just the walkabout is my favorite. You know, when you're either in the evening, I try to do in the evening or at the very least once a week, maybe on a Sunday or something, just walk around the farm and just look at things and see how they're doing and make notes and kind of prepare yourself for the next day or the next week. But it's great because you're not out there to do anything. You're probably going to see lots of things to do, but you're not out there to do anything. And you get to kind of step back and look at everything as a whole. And like I said, if things are going well, then you can kind of admire your weed-free patch of kale or whatever it is.
I like that. Okay, cool. Jacob, tell us about the best crop you ever grew. Was there one year where things were like just so prolific you were giving it away and you just couldn't believe how good things came out?
Boy, the best crop we ever grew. You know, our cherry tomatoes do really well.
Okay.
Typically from year to year. I mean, cherry tomatoes tend to, at least in our experience, tend to be pretty prolific anyway. And so we certainly had a lot this year.
Perfect. What's the best gardening advice you have ever received?
I can't remember who told me this, but it's funny. The advice was to take advice, either solicited or unsolicited. Take advice because you don't have to use it. But if you're not given it, then you're not given that opportunity to hear it.
Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that, and it was very true when we first started. We had a lot of people offering us unsolicited advice, and sometimes it would really bug me. Like, I didn't ask you for that advice, but then I'd step back and say, well, what does it matter? Like, now, you know, now I've gotten a little bit of information from somebody with more experience. I don't have to use that advice, but now I know a little more.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. What's your favorite tool that you like to use? Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
That is so hard. do you want an actual gardening tool?
No.
Okay.
got something else?
I do. I think the internet. Assuming that wherever I ended up had access to the internet, I'd take the internet. I mean, the internet has created this incredible space for sharing ideas and techniques and all sorts of innovations amongst all farmers. But in my instance, the one places that I'm sort of looking is at other small farmers doing similar things to what we're doing, and that includes. You know, the trouble with the internet is not in the information out there, but in filtering the information because there's so much out there. But you get access to information from all the nation's extension, all their research, their research facilities. You know, like MSU Extension or MSU Research reports, but also University of Minnesota and any other sort of land grant college research that they're doing. As well as individual farmers, whether that's through their blogs or through just through their websites or whatever. And there's all sorts of other organizations doing really cool, interesting things. And of course, there's Facebook and there's Instagram and there's all these social media platforms that farmers are engaging with amongst one another. And it's just really, really, it's a cool tool. I mean, if you want to know how to do something, you just Google it. And then you got to filter out and find out what's useful and what's not useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the seed catalogs, I think, are doing a fantastic job of really helping people there. Like I was, one of my guests recommended the Johnny's seed catalog videos. And then there's another one. I get a email from Peaceful Valley, I think. They have some great videos out there. And then the whole YouTube thing. We've looked, my husband and I got bees recently. We got them 2 years ago and they didn't make it. And then we got a new batch this year. And we've looked on YouTube a lot for information on how to raise our bees. And yeah, I think that's a great one. And I certainly couldn't live without my phone. So that's a good one. How about suggestions for eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time? Now, for you as a farmer, it might not be as, but like once again, and I know my husband planted a mini farm this year, so we had more of some things, but to me, it just seems like everything comes on all at once. And like my eggplants came on at the same time the squashes were ready, and I just was inundated, but it wasn't enough to like take anywhere, or I wasn't going to go to town on a special day just to hit the food pantry, especially with eggplants. I thought, you know, how many people are really going to want them? Like that always say, and usually my big one is in the spring is the lettuce. I just seem to have like proliferations of lettuce. Do you have any suggestions for eating or harvesting food on time?
Yeah, you know, it depends on the crop. Like with something like your eggplant and zucchini, you know, with eggplant anyway, you typically plant it once and you want to plant it as early as you can because we have a pretty short growing season. And so it comes whenever it comes, assuming you planted it early enough. So, you know, some things you can't quite control, but for something like zucchini, you know, usually in Montana, you can do a couple successions. So you can plant once and then a couple weeks later plant again. And so you do have a couple windows. So if maybe you only plant the first time, but not the second time, if you know that you're going to get some eggplant around the same time that second crop of zucchini would be coming in. And for things like lettuce is a great one because it grows so fast that you can do multiple successions to get either a weekly supply, or at any time in the season, you can say, I want lettuce, you know, on this day. So let me backtrack, you know, 4 weeks or however many weeks, whatever, how many days of maturity it is, and plant it then so that I know I'm going to get it at this time. You know, if you inundated it with lettuce, maybe you ended up planting too much at once, or maybe your staggered planting was too close together and the varieties were, you know, different maturity dates so that one was faster than the other. And so you're harvesting the two at the same time.
Yeah, nope. I usually just put it in once and have, I just usually plant black-seeded Simpson. I don't really play with a lot of different varieties of lettuce. I've never thought of doing that, like looking, going backwards, saying, I want it on this date. That's a good idea.
You okay, can, cool. And if you're working with the same variety or with the same days to maturity of different varieties, you know, that's one thing. But another strategy, like in your case, if you just don't have the time, you just need to get things in the spring and then water and walk away, then pick a handful of varieties of the same crop with different maturity dates so that you plant it once, but then your earliest maturing, you'll harvest that and you're done with that. And then your next maturing, that'll be, you know, a few days later, then you can harvest that. So they're not all coming on at once, but you planted them at the same time.
I like that. That was like one of my big lessons I took away from this year, is that I need to really pay attention to varieties and read my seed packets better. And I think like I learned a lot this year about what I'm looking for when I get my seed packets and when I'm reading them. So I've definitely learned a lot from my podcast for sure.
Yeah.
How about, do you have any secrets for preserving food or making it last? Do you do any like drying or canning or any of that kind of thing?
You know, we always make promises to each other, my wife and I, that we're going to do better at preserving food.
Cool.
But when the middle of summer hits, it's often a lot more difficult than it sounds. But one really go-to method that we really like is just simply freezing stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do a lot of just straight putting stuff in the freezer and then mm-hmm. pulling it out in the middle of winter. Or some things require blanching, which isn't too time consuming, and then popping in the freezer.
Mm-hmm. I like that. And I learned my one of my most popular guests, this woman, Megan Kane from the Creative Vegetable Farmers, had a blog post about you could freeze peppers just straight, just cut red peppers or green peppers and freeze them. And I never knew you could do that before. I'm big on freezing. My husband and I are definitely getting a big freezer next year. And then he's hopefully going to build a root cellar.
Yeah.
That we definitely need to upgrade.
Yeah. And, you know, like cherry tomatoes or any tomatoes, you can just put on a baking sheet, put it in the freezer until they're hard. And then
you can?
When they're little rocks, then you just put them in a bag and put them back in the freezer. Yeah, just put them on, just lay them flat.
You don't have to blanch them or anything?
No. And then you've got, you know, frozen tomatoes. And then, of course, they're not going to be like fresh slicing when you pull them out of the freezer. They will have, you know, they'll be all kind of, once they thaw out. But you can make your sauces and, you know.
Ooh. All right. Jacob, you are full of golden nuggets today. Listeners are going to love this. Okay. How about, got any special techniques for cooking weird or unusual foods, or weird or unusual techniques for cooking ordinary foods?
You know, back to, I have a couple, couple things. Cool. Back to the kale. My wife makes a really great, and we also, we tell all of our customers about it, a massaged kale salad.
Ooh.
And because kale is a little bit tougher than other leafy greens, you know, I love to eat spinach just by itself, no cooking, and of course, lettuce or salad mix. But kale can be a little bit tougher if you're eating it fresh, and the way to help with that is to massage it, and you literally are just chopping up the kale into pieces, bite-sized pieces, and then just squeezing it with your hands, and that helps to, essentially, it's a way of cooking it. You're just breaking down some of the cell walls and tenderizing it, essentially.
Oh, I like that. One of my first guests, this woman, Patty Ann, who's actually with the minister at my church, talked about doing that with kale. When she makes her kale chips, she kind of massages the olive oil in, and then I think she sprinkles Parmesan on them and bakes them.
Mm-hmm.
But that sounds good for a salad. I like that idea.
And the other one I would say is that our eggplant was incredibly prolific. Actually, it was probably more prolific than our cherry tomatoes this year.
Ooh, okay.
And so we had a lot of eggplant to bring to Farmer's Market. And they're beautiful. They're just shiny purple. They almost look alien. Mm-hmm. And it was surprising that not a lot of people know what to do with eggplant. I mean, they've heard of eggplant Parmesan, and that's about it. But one of my favorite recipes is to put the whole whole eggplants, you know, three or four on the grill, and you char the skin, so you're just constantly turning the eggplant till the whole skin is charred, and then once it's cooled down, then you scoop out the insides and put it into a food processor, and you add tahini and garlic and olive oil and salt and lemon juice, I think, and you make baba ganoush, which is kind of like hummus. It's just this really creamy dip out of eggplant, and the charring on the grill gives it a really nice smoky flavor.
Cool.
But it's very, very easy.
Oh, I like all of that. And somebody else I talked to the other day said that if you do that, then when you scoop that inside out, you can just throw that in a freezer bag and freeze it really easy too. I didn't know you could do that with eggplant.
Yeah.
She said she didn't like to freeze the skins, but she just roasted them in the oven. But that would work too, roasting it on the grill. So if you had like some extras there. Cool. What's your favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden?
My wife is more the cook than I am. I'm a real simpleton in the kitchen. I like sauteing anything, most anything in a scrambled egg dish, like just saute, you don't even just saute eggplant, but saute spinach or kale or whatever green is out there.
You know, that's what I was thinking when you said that about the eggplant, because that's my favorite way to eat it, is just saute it lightly in olive oil. And, you know, I did eat a lot of our eggplants. The other thing I think the secret to cooking eggplant is if you harvest them when they're young, when they're little, you know, to me, zucchinis and eggplants, like we don't get a ton of zucchinis because I don't let them get that big because I like them. And I put zucchinis on everything. Like I slice them on sandwiches or throw it on pizza, or just like I'll throw zucchinis. Like I eat a zucchini almost every day when they're coming. But I like them just like small, like, I don't know, as round as a quarter, maybe a little bigger than a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And so eggplant's I'm kind of the same way. But I love, yeah, that's my favorite way to eat eggplant, is just to fry it in just a tiny little bit of olive oil, just enough to, so it doesn't, you know, burn or whatever. I'm like that too. Just saute it.
Yeah.
So we did kind of talk about the internet. I guess you were saying the extension agents. Is there like a favorite source, or is that it, the extension agents, or somewhere you like to go?
You know, any land grant university extension, and depending on where you are in the country, or where you look in the country, oftentimes their extension is, the research that they do is based on the primary agricultural industry in the area. You know, there's certainly a lot of small grain research done out of Montana State University. But if you go into some other parts of the country where there's more vegetable growing, they actually have programs dedicated to high tunnel experiments, for example, or hoop house experiments, or other vegetable farm related things. So certainly you'd have to search around, and MSU Extension also has quite a few good fact sheets on small scale stuff too, gardening and preserving and fruit tree maintenance and things like that. So they have a lot of good resources. But I would say my favorite is the ATRA project. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Go ahead and tell listeners though.
The ATRA project is part of the NCAT, which is the National Center for Appropriate Technology. And it's a program that has a lot of wonderful information on all sorts of aspects of agriculture, not just gardening, but livestock and marketing and equipment and all sorts of things. And they have a big database you can search and find existing articles. But the neat thing about ATRA is that they also have a 1-800 number, and you can call them with a question. And then within a few days or a week or so, they will get back to you with an answer.
Cool. I have, actually, that's interesting, because I got a magnet for ATRA at the Aero conference, and I have it right on my filing cabinet right next to where I sit, but I didn't realize that that's what that 800 number is there for, so cool.
Yeah.
I'll put that in the show notes if listeners want it. What's your favorite, like, do you have a favorite book or a magazine that you like, do you want to recommend, or even a blog or a website or something?
Well,
I mean, I guess we talked about that website.
Yeah, on the internet, it's so vast. You know, I get Acres USA, which is a monthly magazine, just chock full of information.
Oh, cool.
And it typically has something for everyone: home gardener, rancher, vegetable, you know, hog or whatever it is. They always have articles, but it's pretty pretty good magazine. The other one I really like is Growing for Market, which is a monthly magazine dedicated to market gardeners, people who are growing vegetables for farmers market or CSAs, as well as cut flower farms. And that one's a really, really good one too, with really practical articles.
Cool. I've had that one recommended before, but I should subscribe to that. That's a good point. Wait, how big is your place again? Did you tell us? I think I've been meaning to ask you that.
I don't think I did. We have a 30-acre farm, and about, including cover crops, a little under 4 acres of vegetables. So that does include the cover crops as well. And then we have the remainder is in kind of grass pasture and hay and grain.
Cool. Okay. Do you have any advice, like business advice for listeners on how to like either sell extra produce or get started in the industry?
Well, we went right into trying to start a business. Mm-hmm. And I wish I had started gardening first and then gone into starting a farm business.
Oh, okay.
Just because then you could learn at a more reasonable scale and you know, make plenty of mistakes, and it's no big deal. Not that the mistakes we made when we were started were a big deal either. But so I guess I can't speak to somebody who's gardening that wants to start a farm, because that's not what we did. But just from my...
Well, how about if somebody wants to do what you do and they just want to jump right in and start off with a business right off the bat?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess what I was going to say is that if I wouldn't sell surplus unless you had, unless you had like an outlet like a farmer's market. Because one thing that we've found over the years is that people like consistency. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to, you know, selling surplus to a farmer's market's great. But if you want to do a CSA, then you almost have to commit to growing for a CSA. You know, you have to kind of have to make that leap where you're making sure that your CSA members have something every week. And not just if it's extra or surplus.
Right.
But I, you know what, I think that maybe the biggest advice is just certainly start small. You know, start with 10 CSA members or even 5 and see what it takes to plan out a full season of a weekly box of produce.
Yeah, because that's what, like, that was the biggest thing I saw. Like, we had some really nice boxes that we could have given out, you know, at the end of like September or the end of August, the beginning of September. But I kept thinking, what would we, like, I just can't even like picture. It's very hard for me to see what we would do if we had to start producing boxes for people, you know, at the beginning of the spring. You know, maybe it starts around May, June, July. Just our harvests were just like few and far between. So I think that's going to be a huge thing for us. So
yeah.
That's definitely something I've learned from the show, though, is to try to start with a small group, like 5 to 10 people in the beginning. So we might, I don't know if we're going to try to do that next year yet, or if we're going to wait one more year.
Yeah.
I don't know. My husband today was talking about how much he wants a tractor.
There it is.
He's been wanting a tractor for years, I know.
Well, and as soon as he gets a tractor, you know that you're starting a farm.
Yeah, well, we got sheep this year. We got 4 sheep. I don't know. It's been maybe a month ago now. And well, our biggest thing has been water, and we finally dug a deep well two years ago. So we finally have, like, this is the first year we've ever been able to put like a sprinkler on and really grow like a lot of stuff. So we'll see. Okay, here's my final question. Ready? It's a doozy. If there's one change you would like to see, Jacob, to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or globally?
Wow. Boy, I mean, I'd like to see more people on the land. I think that just the disconnect that we have from our food causes all sorts of problems down the line. It'd be great to get people back connected to the land in some way, so it doesn't have to be them gardening or farming, but certainly have a direct connection to their food, so that they understand where it comes from and get a better understanding of the ramifications of this global food system that we live in. Nice. I think that, you know, that disconnect that we have in our society now is one of many problems we have in this society, but one that, you know, that I'm intimately involved with. So it's on the top of my head.
Yeah. And, you know, we all eat. It's one thing we all do.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing where your food comes from and like how it, you know, how it affects everything, how, you know, what you buy and what you grow, or, you know, what you feed yourself affects, is more than just, you know, affecting you, how it affects other people and our system, like you said.
And, you know, I think we're certainly becoming more aware. And, you know, it's not just knowing where your vegetables come from. It's knowing where your meat comes from. It's knowing where your grain comes from. And ever more, it's going to be knowing where your seeds come from. And from the farmer perspective, that's critically important to know where your seeds come from. And we don't know where all our seeds come from. But certainly from the eater perspective, knowing where the farmer's seeds come from is also very important to know and understand.
Do you want to talk to us about grains at all? We didn't really talk about that much. Do you want to say anything else? Did I skip anything there?
So like I said, we grow on a really small scale, and so we focus on really unique varieties, older older varieties of grain. So we grow a heritage wheat called Sonora, which was originally grown in the Sonora region of Mexico in the 1700s. It's a tortilla wheat. We use it for tortillas, which makes great tortillas, but also for sourdough bread. And we also grow emmer, which is an ancient wheat that was grown over 10,000 years in the Fertile Crescent. And so we are always looking for different and unique older varieties. There's a lot of really valuable genetics in these varieties that we're trying to explore. And so we do a lot of trialing of not just wheat, but also older varieties of barley. We found some really beautiful black, deep, dark black colored hullus barleys that we want to try to explore more.
Like that?
We find them from all over. There's a handful of private individuals who have small collections that we've gotten a few ounces from. Most of our seed has come from the USDA's small grains germplasm, and it's a public resource. But they maintain, I think, thousands of varieties of all different crops. But the small grains is for wheat and barley, and you only get depending on the variety, sometimes it's just 30 seeds or just an ounce or two of any given variety. So then, of course, you have to grow it and save the seed and then grow it again and expand the seed and grow it again, expand it even more. But that's where we found most of our different varieties. And we're still looking and still trialing.
Cool.
And it's not just, not just trialing how they do out in our field and in our region. And, most of the varieties that we're choosing are what are considered landrace varieties, which are varieties that are genetically diverse. And so one variety name, you plant out those 30 seeds, those 30 plants are genetically diverse amongst each other. So they look the same, but they actually are genetically different. They're not all the same. And the advantage to that is that they will then have a better chance of adapting to your particular environment. So that's really the first step for us. The second step is that once we find ones that are very adaptable to our environment or that we have adapted to our environment, we need to expand the seed enough that we can have enough seed to plant again the next year, but also to take with us into the kitchen and start seeing what their culinary characteristics are.
Oh, okay. You know what I want to ask you? So, did you say you're making tortillas?
Yes.
Do you have a good recipe for making tortillas? I've been begging my husband to make me tortillas because he's the baker too, and he bakes bread. And I'm like, why don't you make me tortillas?
I do. It's really simple, and I would have to look up exactly the amounts, but it's really basic. It's just our Sonora flour, and you could probably use any flour, but it's 100% whole wheat, olive oil, and salt.
Really?
I think that's it.
Okay.
And then there must be some water in there. But then you mix it all together, and then you put it in the refrigerator. And once it's kind of stiffened up and given a chance to kind of absorb all the liquids, then you just simply roll it out. You can pat it out with your fist or your hand, or you can pat it out with your fist or your hand and then use a rolling pin to flatten it further and just put it in the frying pan with a little bit of olive oil, and after maybe 15-20 seconds, flip it, and that's it.
Maybe that's what I've been doing wrong, is I've never put it in the fridge, because I tried to make them once and it was just a disaster. So
the recipe comes from the Whole Grain Connection.
Okay.
So yeah, if you just look up Whole Grain Connection, there's a link on the side that says recipes, and then there's the whole wheat tortilla recipe.
Cool. Thanks. All right. Anything else I've forgotten?
I can't think of anything.
Okay. How about an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
Well, I would just say just go for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you've taught us a ton today. You really have. So I think people will just be inspired hearing your stories.
Okay.
Do you want to tell listeners how to connect with you?
Yeah, they can find this at our website at prairieheritagefarm.com. And we have our email address there, and we have a Facebook account and an Instagram account, and we frequently post photos so people can kind of follow along and see what we're up to that way as well.
Thank you so much, Jacob.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow.